Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 30th, 1999, and in the fireside room this morning is Cynthia Mo Libida's session called Globalization Disabling Neighbor Love and Christian Mysticism as Source of Faithful Resistance. Let's listen in.
I'm Cynthia Mo Libida, and I am a doctoral student in Christian Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York. Just by way of introduction, kind of related to this subject matter, my previous main work was directing the Washington, D.C. office of the Center for Global Education, which is at Oxford College in Minneapolis. Some of you may be familiar with the center. Our time together in these five sessions, I intend to revolve around an enormous and vastly disturbing contradiction. A contradiction that has ripped my guts since I was about 16 years old. And the way I see it is this, and I've written up here, we're called to love neighbor, we Christians are called to love neighbor as self, and to, as Deuteronomy says, to choose life so that you and your descendants may live. This is our calling, and not only our calling, but our gift. It's our primary life work here on earth. It's why we're here. And I dare to say that most of us long to fulfill that calling and that gift. Yet in tragic contrast and defying our better judgment, defying our call, we who are the affluent of North America find ourselves in a kind of ungodly situation. And again, I've written that here. We seem locked into complicity with global economic arrangements that drink the blood of the poor throughout the world and threaten the Earth's regenerative capacities in order that a few, including most of us, might consume as much as we want, and a tiny elite might concentrate enormous wealth in their hands. In these sessions together, these five, we will face this contradiction, the call to love neighbor and the mandates of a global economy that demand us to exploit and brutalize. And by the demand to exploit and brutalize, what I mean is things like our shirts are made in sweatshops where people die at age 25. Our children's soccer balls are made by 10-year-olds whose eyes go out by the time they're 15 from making those soccer balls. So this is the contradiction that I ask us to grapple with. But I do want you to hear me very clearly. My intent is not that we sit here for five times together and wallow in the horror of it all, which we could easily do. My intent is rather that we, for those of you who just came in, I've kind of said that we intend to grapple with a contradiction that has ripped me up for about two decades. And I've written it up here. It's the call to love neighbor as self and to choose life so that you and your descendants might live. And in contrast to that, we're stuck locked into the lifestyle of a global economy that essentially demands us to brutalize the poor and to literally threaten the capacity of the earth to sustain life as we know it. How do we live with that contradiction? And as I was saying, we're not going to sit here for five sessions together and wallow in the horror of it and the guilt of it all. My intent is that we name the contradiction and then get into understanding how it works for the purpose of seeking God-given and grace-filled power to live otherwise. If our Christian tradition offers us anything, it must offer us the power to live toward our call. That is, the power to live toward lives that love the other and serve the well-being of the earth. So my intent is that we struggle with this contradiction for the purpose of uncovering some of the paths toward that power. So what I propose we do is work on two distinct questions that flow out of this contradiction for me. And I've written down the questions for you. One of the questions is this. If the prevailing model of economic globalization today brutalizes many who are poor and jeopardizes the Earth's regenerative capacities, then why do Christians in the U.S. acquiesce to those systems without declaring them an affront to our faith? What could be so powerful to allow us to accept an economic status quo that leads to millions of silent deaths each year? And I'm going to propose a line of response to that that we explore, and it is this. I would suggest that economic globalization in its dominant form disables our moral power. That is our capacity to love neighbor and to choose life in the ways in which we live. It disables our capacity to forge alternatives that are more faithful to our call to serve the well-being of God's creation. Notice in our liturgy, we pledge ourselves, I commit myself to the care and redemption of all that God has made. So I am simply going to suggest that globalization in the form that we now live it disables our power to do just that. And we'll explore how that happens. The second question following that is, where in our Christian faith tradition are we offered hope and spiritual moral power to resist, to revision, and to rebuild economic ways which nurture communities and the earth community, which nurture communities and an earth community that will sustain life according to justice and compassion for generations to come? Not for 5 years to come, but for ongoing generations to come. And what I propose that we do is delve into the Christian mystical traditions. I would suggest that some of the power to resist, or as I would say, to subvert, to overturn ways of economic brutality, lie in the very fact that we are beloved and that God dwells in us, that the spirit of the God who served life even under the threat of death by torture, the love of that God is breathed into us, is promised to us, and is breathed into us, and that our tradition continues to teach us that we are the dwelling place of that incredibly unquenchable, powerful love. Yet our Protestant tradition has sort of stepped away from claiming and knowing the power of the indwelling God, that mystical reality that we bear the Spirit and the God in us. And I would like us to explore together what kind of moral power comes out of being the dwelling place of the God of great liberating love. When I say moral power, I mean something in specific by that. When I speak of the moral life, I simply mean how we live in response to our faith. And I have said spiritual moral power because, as an ethicist, I've been rather stunned by the fact that we tend to separate ethics from spirituality in our tradition. Some people deal with ethics or social justice. Other people deal with prayer and spirituality, the contemplative life. And to me, that's a terribly false divorce, that our spiritual power is our moral power, and the two not be dissociated. So that's why, where some people might say moral power, I consider moral power and spiritual power one and the same thing. What I would like to do today is really just explore, kind of unravel, look at those two questions and those two paths of response, rather than to dig in depth into any of them. But before we do, let me just ask if there are any questions. Does this seem like a bus you want to be on for a little while, or problems with it, concerns, different paths to explore?
Bring it on.
I would like us to pursue this, because these are, in our area in South Dakota, in terms of the agricultural scene, these are very pertinent questions, and I see no answers to them in a sense.
Say just a moment more, Leroy, what you meant about the agricultural scene makes these pertinent questions.
Well, for example, we have a man living near us who farms 88 quarters of land. Mm-hmm. That's 44 sections. Mm-hmm. And if we ask the question, what has this man done to our rural economy, our rural small town Main Street, our rural schools, our rural churches? And yet his reply will be, well, the prevailing model of economic globalization forces me to do this.
So you're saying it's had a destructive impact on your rural life, and he's saying he's forced into it.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that I think that's a really good example of what I'm talking about. The notion that he probably doesn't want to be destructive to rural South Dakota, but he can't force his way out of a system that's...
His own church has had to close.
Oh, there's direct impact.
Wow.
Cynthia, I'm intrigued by this too because I think I was telling you this, Paul. I heard Desmond Tutu speak last winter, and from his experience in South Africa, he was speaking using the Micah text, and he was taking those three mandates for us: do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. And he was also turning them around the way I see you doing it, which is that he thought the order was more apt if you said that when you walk humbly with God, the other two are the fruition of that.
I hadn't heard him say that, and I hadn't thought about it specifically that way, but that is very, very parallel to what I'm saying. Somehow the notion of a deep, deep, powerful, intimate relationship with the God in us cannot be dissociated from the fact that, or how we live, not only in relationship to the person next door, but the person across town and across the ocean. Well, what I'd like to do, I have made claims. I've made tremendous claims that are very contestable here. I've said that the global economy is killing people. I've said that the way we live is blood, that our clothes carry blood on them. And we could cite statistics and quotes and all kinds of arguments to prove that, and that's not what I'd like to spend our time doing. I'd like to just share amongst us maybe a few voices or experiences in our own lives that suggest the reality that life as we know it costs other people their lives. Some of you may live with that reality every day and have many experiences. For others, that may be a very, very new concept. I'd like to share with you just a couple of voices from my life that have taught me this reality, and then ask if any of you have any to share from yours. But first of all, to demonstrate the contradiction, would someone be willing to read aloud Mark 12:28-31? I've marked it here.
We don't have time.
I have it. Yeah, here you go.
Mark
and
12.
Read nice and loudly. It's right marked in pencil to make it easy.
Okay. One of the scribes came near and heard them disputing with one another. And seeing that he answered them well, he asked him, "Which commandment is the first of all?" Jesus answered, "The first is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' The second is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these."
So what I want us to focus on for a minute is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then I share just a couple of voices from my experience. One is, I spent years as a missionary in Honduras. And out of all those experiences, one of the things that burns in my mind is working with peasant people whose babies did were horribly malnourished. Death came from malnourishment in Honduras. And strong, fiercely courageous, hardworking people who wanted nothing more than un perecito de tierra, a little piece of land on which to grow beans, corn, and verduras, vegetables, so that their children could live. And the land was owned, the arable land, by foreign cattle companies from the U.S., and the cattle was exported, and the people died. And someone made big bucks in the U.S. on that cattle. And then I contrast that with love thy neighbor as thyself, and it doesn't work. And another experience from my life, as I said, I worked for the Center for Global Education. I led delegations of people to Central America and many places, and there were many experiences meeting with a vast array of society, from presidents and generals to guerrillas in the mountains. But I'll never forget many voices, and one is the voice, this was in Mexico, of a strawberry picker, who said to me, and he was a Christian, and he didn't say it with hatred in his voice, he said it to teach me something. He said, our children die of malnourishment because our land grows these strawberries for your tables. And you know, things once seen can never be unseen. I can't unsee that man's face. Always the voice of the poor in Central America would say, without hate, without anger, go back and tell your people about the political and economic arrangements that cost us our lives. So those are two voices, and I'll share one more. This is the voice of Bishop Bernardino Manlate, a Methodist bishop in Mozambique. I was on a panel speaking at the UN with him, and I wrote down part of what he said because I thought it was so pertinent. He was speaking about life in the north. He said, what I want, now he's not talking about his reality, he's describing what he sees as the northern, the US reality. What I want has replaced what I need. What I want is a list which increases due to market forces. It includes what other people need, and I am prepared to sacrifice millions around the world to ensure that I live with what I want. Africans suffer and starve so that the living standards in the global north can be maintained and improved. Millions of African children die of malnutrition to ensure that children of the north can overeat. Africa is forced to drain its major resources to service the foreign debt. The debt is full of blood. And again, I contrast that to love thy neighbor, and again, it doesn't work. And then I don't want to stop right there, and I won't go into a lot more voices. I'll go into one more. The other biblical passage that has become extremely important to me around this is the Deuteronomic text. Remember in Deuteronomy, before they go into the Promised Land, and Moses says this, and I'll read it to you. Deuteronomy 30, someplace in Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30, 19. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curse. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. And I see that in relationship to the way in which our economic life chooses death for the earth. Is anyone here familiar with the State of the World report, the annual report that comes out? There was one quote from the State of the World report 1998 about biodiversity that I wanted to share in relationship to this Choose Life. The State of the World report says, biodiversity is the basis for our existence. However, like the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, humanity now finds itself in the midst of a mass extinction, a global evolutionary convulsion with few parallels in the entire history of life. Most estimates are that at least 1,000 species are lost per year, but unlike the dinosaurs, we are not simply the contemporaries of a mass extinction, we are the reason for it. Reversing this trend calls for a restructuring of the global economy. It calls for replacing our consumer culture with a less materialistic and far more environmentally literate way of life. The fate of our children depends upon it in ways that we can barely begin to conceive. And then I hear Deuteronomy in my mind. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. And it seems to me that something is terribly wrong, especially for those of us who claim that our life is resourced by the God of this scripture. Take a moment, perhaps, just to reflect on your own lives, the voices, the people, the experiences. Are there moments in your life when the glaring contradiction between the way we live and the call to choose life and love neighbor is present? Do you see and experience that contradiction? And I wondered if you might think of a moment when that contradiction was real to you, or also think of a moment when you've run away from that contradiction as fast as you could run. I run from it daily, probably.
I have an experience that comes to mind, leaps to mind right away. Just last February, you know, tripping my way down the produce section at the local mega superstore, and found little packages of raspberries in February. It was about $6 for a half pint. And so I looked in the label, and in very tiny print, it said that they came from either Peru or Chile. And I thought, what a huge amount of resources goes into growing those raspberries and getting them to us. And there's obviously a market for them. People are going to pay $6 for a cup of raspberries.
In the winter.
And then I looked into that a little bit, and I think I spoke to you, and you told me the story about the Mexican farmer who said, yes, we grow strawberries for you, and our children cannot eat as a result.
Wow, that's a good example.
I have a different image. It's from my childhood. I was in India, in Bombay. We were there for a year and a half when I was about 5 years old. And there were beggars on the streets, maimed, whatever, asking for handouts from, I guess, they knew where the Americans were or whatever. And my mother told me that she could not give anything to these beggars because if you gave it to one, then you'd have to give it to everybody. And so this addresses how you get unempowered because you just cannot deal with it at that level of loving your neighbor. I mean, it's a contradiction there about loving your neighbor. And they actually, I mean, they maim themselves so that they are more desired, you know, more likely to get up. And that's an example of, I mean, it's not, you know, a direct connection about what they're doing that creates a need for them to do that, but they are doing that. That is happening.
It's so overwhelming for somebody like his mother or any of us. It's overwhelming.
Other comments or thoughts? I want to actually come back in a couple minutes to what you just said, Woody, because I think it's really important, the words that you used of unempowered and overwhelmed. Maybe just a moment to hear if there are other examples. Virginia.
When we were living in North Carolina, I remember it came out, well, the governor there was trying to hold on to chicken farming, the Purdue chicken and the chicken plants and the textile mills and trying to keep that industry in there as well as the high-tech stuff of the Research Triangle Park. And it came out that he had made a promise to a lot of these companies that the labor force that did not graduate from high school that would be have to be hired at minimum wage or less would be a larger percentage than it currently was. He was promising them that he would increase that percent of the labor force, and that was the same year that the standardized testing for high school graduation went into effect to increase our academic standards. With a real direct correlation that there he would produce more to make sure that in the state this cheap labor force was available. And at that same time, we were living in the inner city and saw the kids who were going to go down that path that did not have a future. They didn't have adequate housing. There was not the counseling and psychological stuff available for them, for the violence that they lived in the midst of, the tremendous drug trade and all that was during the Contra War and the connections there. And knowing personally the kids whose lives were at a dead end because the governor was promising this. In addition to the fact, this was the same governor who said that one of his goals was to have a major 4 or 6 lane highway within 20 miles of every town in the state. And that's where the money was going because that also increased trade and manufacturers.
What a goal.
And you take these beautiful mountainous towns with their little roads and everything is getting plowed so that there's place for all the produce or the production to go.
Where is this?
North Carolina.
But that is that when you begin to read the literature, that is not uncommon. So you're saying he was ensuring a workforce that would not graduate from high school so that they could be paid minimum wage.
Yeah, it was found in writing that he was going to increase the percentage. in his promise to these companies.
And that's at a time in which, according to Forbes magazine 1998 survey of CEO salaries, the average CEO earns 419 times what his or her lowest paid worker earns. Mm-hmm. And that is a very specific example of what we're talking about. Low paid workers, minimum wage spells death for many people. Minimum wage means you use candles in your house to produce light, and then your apartment burns and your kids die. Minimum wage means you work two jobs and your kids end up on the streets because no one's home.
That happened a lot in the projects near us. There would be one or two parents, both working two jobs, and the kids are out on their own on the streets.
Well, I think that's a very good example. I don't want to cut anyone else off. Maybe we could hold what you said, Virginia, and juxtapose it with what you said, Woody, about being disempowered and overwhelmed. We do feel disempowered. All of us in here are probably people of enormous compassion, and we do long to live in right relationship, righteously, in right relationship. None of us wants to buy products from a company that pays its workers so low that they can't live and pays its CEO 419 times as much. None of us wants a shirt made in a sweatshop. None of us wants raspberries grown where people should have grown beans and corn. It's the pathos of the situation is really stunning. It's overwhelming. We end up locked into these situations that we clearly don't want.
But we have complicity in that it creates, it's here, it's reality.
It is reality.
I mean, it's not like, you know, all those bad people out there did it. They're the same as us.
Yes.
What I hear from Cynthia is that we're in complicity because we don't speak out against it. We let it happen without saying, well, maybe I don't buy those raspberries, or maybe I don't buy those shirts, or maybe I don't, you know, do this stuff. But if it's there, and we know it's there, and we don't say anything, there's complicity.
But there is, we don't also recognize the ways in which we are active.
You know, that too, but at least you can't say, well, I'm not buying the shirts, so I'm okay.
But how do we attack, let's say, McDonald's, who owns thousands of acres in the Dominican Republic and turned them into pastures for their cattle so that they have hamburgers to sell up here, and land that has been taken away from the peasant farmer, and he's starving? How do we attack that? I mean, we're a voice crying in the wilderness, I think.
Well, are we?
That's my point.
We're crying.
Well, maybe that's a good point.
We come at the fact.
Yeah. Every time you drink a dress, that contradiction has to hit you right in the face. I mean, I'm putting on Colombia, God knows where they produce their stuff. I'm sure my shoes, I know that those were produced cheaply, but I want shoes that I can afford.
Of course, in a lot of cases they're produced cheaply, but you know, they're brand names here that carry outrageous prices.
Or yeah, the company, but even if you're aware of it, and if you choose to buy it in an outlet because you're living very simply on a low income or a non-taxable income, you end up shopping at Costco or someplace because it's cheap. Exactly. With this awareness, you still buy into the system. It's so hard to get out of.
You know, what's kind of an interesting way to watch somebody working up against it, and I don't know that he's a Christian. He's certainly not doing it from that approach, but it's to take a look at Roger Moore's two movies.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Yeah. No, same.
Like the first one is about the Flint, Michigan closing down of the car.
The CEO, the president.
And the second one's about Nike. It's called The Big One. What's the first one called? Roger and Me. Yeah, it's incredible to watch him because that's what he does. He just walks in the door. And you know, a lot of times it's just him saying, how much are you making compared to your lowest paid worker? And putting a microphone in people's faces. And it's just incredible to actually watch a citizen, you know, making a big stink in front of a lot of people.
So he's making it visible. So he's making it visible.
Yeah.
Yes. So you use the word a voice crying in the wilderness. You use making it visible. I went through years of hating white middle class America, to tell you the truth. It was a very destructive way for me to live. It was my own people. And I began to realize that we are subject to. We are not, yes, we are complicit, we are acquiescent, we are doing this, but we're also subject to a kind of globalization structure that is forcing us into these ways. Virginia, you spoke of it well. You can decide on simple living, and then you end up buying cheaper stuff that is even more exploitatively produced. It seems as though we're almost forced to bow at the altar of profit and consumption, almost choosing to and forced to at the same time. It does seem, and Leroy, you spoke up, how do you, and we're a voice crying in the wilderness, it does seem to me that we are called to a radically different mode of life. It probably has to take place in community of one form or another. It is defiant of having things to the extent that we have. It's defiant of the level of comfort that we assume. You know, another vision I have is of my precious Seattle and people now driving around in their, what do you call them, SUVs that are so comfortable that it's like going into a back massage when you sit down in them and you punch a button before you get to it so your door opens. And this is normal people who don't make big money, but the need for having and comfort. Someone who was preaching the other night said, I know when I'll get back, I'll need a new pair of shoes. Not need, but want. And I do think, I glimpse, and I think we all glimpse, that the way of life, that humanity, Western affluent humanity, is called to a thoroughly, radically different way of life, unless we want life to stop as we know it. I fear the powerlessness, the disempowerment, the despair, the hopelessness that comes out of seeing. I have been very tempted to decide not to see. And that's why this phrase, things once seen cannot be unseen, is important to me. I believe that I have encountered and sunk into despair and hopelessness about this situation, and therefore I do fear it. And so I think that, I mean, I see kind of a progression of questions. One is, what is going on? And I think that one of our tasks is to see very clearly what's going on, and that's going to be one of the jobs of the next couple of sessions that we'll work on, clearly. What is going on with the global economy so that we can unravel it, so we can understand the power dynamics at play? I think that we all assume we can't understand, that it's for economists to understand. And I will hold up one of my chief operating principles, and that is that economics is understandable to people untrained in economics. And I do think that the war against the poor today is an economic war. We're not funding the Contras anymore in Nicaragua. It's not as much a military war as an economic war. So one of the questions is, what the hell is going on? How does this happen? A second question, and I think it's sort of the one that Leroy pointed to, is how can things be different? We can look to our Christian tradition. What are norms by which we can live otherwise? And there are many norms, the great economy of life. And we can look to the many alternatives that are being promoted and thought of and understood and lived by people throughout the world, but that the public eye is not on. There are many alternatives out there. You don't need to read for more than a week or two to realize that distinct, sophisticated, complicated proposals for other forms of creating a global economy are out there, but they're not in the public discourse. The newspapers don't cover them. The mainstream media doesn't cover them. The politicians don't generally talk about them. So, question one is what's going on. Question two is what could be going on otherwise? How could things be different? Those are usually the two big questions that ethics, Christian ethics, addresses. Well, really, how should we live is the question, the second one. I hold up the first question, that we've got to understand what's going on first. But I would like to suggest a third question. And I move to that one and will move to that one, kind of jumping over the second one. If the second one is how could things be different, I'm jumping over that because we only have 5 hours together, but also because I think there's a lot of literature out there that we can find. The third question to me is, how do we have the power to live towards those alternatives? Everything in our life tells us not to, especially if you have kids, I think. I mean, everything tells you to enter into this mode of life, establish your children in it, and go for their success, moderated by compassion, moderated by love, by service, but get into this way of life and live it. So where do we part the good life? The affirmed life. So where do we find the power to resist, to revision and to rebuild? I don't know if that's a question of importance to you. It's simply become a question of importance to me.
I find myself feeling so powerless in terms, I told you I had 10 grandchildren. And they're old enough to go to school, and unless they have the latest in jeans or you know, the latest name brand clothing, they're ostracized, and they buy into having some kind of drink in their hand all the time, and all of that. They're fast food addicts, and I feel so powerless about that.
Well, does anyone resonate?
Well, the problem there, at least a large part of it, is that wealth is an absolute. It's relative. It's how much more we have than somebody else. I mean, if we all became millionaires all of a sudden, there'd be a lot of people very unhappy because their neighbor had just as much as they did.
Multi-billionaires would be very unhappy.
But I think you said something earlier, something you were starting to talk about community. And I want to address that and what Mary said about Michael Moore. He also has a book out talking about these economic issues. And he, in the introduction of the book, talks about walking down with a couple of movie producers or publishers in New York City, walking down the street, and all of a sudden this homeless man coming up to him and said, "You're Michael Moore, I went to high school with you." Back in Flint, Michigan, I was, you know, fired or laid off by, you know, GM. And he talked about that idea of intellectually saying, these labor practices are wrong, I'm going to do a movie about this. But all of a sudden, like what you were also saying about things being seen, or what is once seen can never be unseen again. When he all of a sudden saw someone that he went to high school with in a small town in Michigan, and now here he's walking with movie producers to do a movie about justice, and here's this homeless man. What is he going to do about that homeless man? And I think, kind of thinking aloud, but it's when we're in community or choose to expand who is in our community that we can't escape it. We can't run away. And with that also that in community, we need the strength of working on it with other people. We can't do it alone. He couldn't just go solve that homeless man's life. But he needed to confront that man because he was a part of his community one way or another. Maybe that's confusing.
No, I think it's very unconfusing. I think that one of the points you make that seems clear to me is that community may no longer be homogeneous. That if our communities in which we discern and struggle together are all kind of like just people like us, we're simply not going to know. We're not going to know what we need to know. It seems to me one of my other operating principles in dealing with economics is if you don't privilege the voice of those whose lives are threatened by economics as we know it, then you simply won't know what you need to know. So privileging the voice of that man in our discernment processes is unnecessary.
I think that your third question is crucial, but that second question just burns me up. And that is, especially, you know what, it's these military skirmishes that we've been having, whatever they call, you know, skirmish in the desert, or, you know, all these names they're giving things now to make them sound like movies, that we don't hear what the other peacemaking options are in places that I'm sure are highly developed and, I mean, have been practiced. And Nelson Mandela can be a part of, and Jimmy Carter, and I mean, they do happen sometimes in smaller and other ways, but that's always the first and most viable option, especially for our country and other major powers. It just makes me furious. Yeah. But then, yeah. what am I doing about it? So that's the third question. You know, why do I feel totally powerless over that situation?
Well, the questions are intimately related. They're not separable. I simply know that you can't talk about everything in about 5 hours, but you've pointed to some things, Mary. I mean, you said we don't know about the other alternatives developed elsewhere. There really are other alternatives to all of this, and so maybe one of our tasks is the commitment of hearing, of seeing otherwise. One can read the newsletters of Pax Christi, the Catholic Peace Organization, and hear concrete alternative proposals to Desert Storm and various things.
I think yes. another example there is where I find the tension on the continuum is a Co-op America mm-hmm. puts out a shopping guide mm-hmm. based upon eight criteria of socially responsible purchasing. And one can get that and then begin individually, privately, to practice that. But the second stage, which is, I think, more challenging for all of us, is the suggestion, now write to those companies and tell them why you're shopping the way you are. Mm-hmm. You know, privately, we can make all kinds of changes, and hopefully, collectively, that will have an impact. But until we're willing to go public, I don't think we are.
Because of this third question, I agree with you that it's much more difficult when you're a parent. Because your children want what everybody else wants. If you want to make your children happy, you've got a real tough choice about what to do. And we, a couple of years ago, sent out a letter at Christmas time about we'd rather not have exchange Christmas presents for everybody.
Yeah.
Over again.
Boy, it sure feels sorry for your kids.
But the challenge for me is how do I articulate a spiritual set of values that is better than what the cultural is teaching them as a set of values that make them happy. And if there's a set of values, if you find the set of values, you will be happy if you can succeed at that. And I'm saying, well, there's got to be a better set of values and a way to live that set of values that would then empower my children to say, this is fulfilling. This is great. But I'm not doing that. I think that's where your other statement is saying, you have to have a community. You can't do this as a one parent or two parents with children saying, we're going to be different than everybody else, and you're going to have great fun doing this.
I think, Woody, you're right. The more that this soaks around in me, the fact that it is not possible as isolated families or individuals. It's not possible. And it really is a theological question. It comes back to the Genesis story. It comes back to the fact that a human being had to have community for life to be. And it raises what in our minds, what is Christian community? What are we called as churches to do and be? It's, if we're worshiping communities, it's also we're called to be worshiping in the way we provide a community, an alternative community for our children. I think it's somewhat uncharted territory that we're called to venture forth upon, and we can't do it alone. Just like we can't start a prayer and Bible reading life alone. It's a function of community, and it has to happen in community. It seems to me, to a certain extent, that. And this is why I moved to the third question, that even knowing the horror of what is, and even beginning to see alternatives to it, the trajectory of our body politic and our political bodies, ourselves and our society, is just to trudge on as we are, to keep going. A year goes by and you're still doing it. You're still living, in a sense, the same way. In a way, it seems that we're so morally malformed into ways of economic injustice that even knowing what's going on and knowing what could be different isn't sufficient to reform us. And that there is more that we need than even knowing. And that's why I'm drawn to think about power. What I call moral spiritual power. Power to resist domination. I would suggest that we are subject to a massive force of domination in economics as we know it. We're subject to domination. And that, period. And then I would say that the voice of our time together here ought be hope. And that the streams and rays of hope are many. And one of those streams of hope, rivers of life, is provided by people throughout the world who are developing and living. And we must begin to read, see, meet, know, follow those examples and create our own. I think the rivers of hope are also found in the great faith traditions of this earth, all of which must be drawn upon now if humanity is to radically change. Or let me say, if Western industrialized humanity is to radically change. That since the Enlightenment, you know, religion has been low on the totem pole of human endeavor. Science and reason have taken the top. But at this point, in the postmodern world, in the world with the capability of destroying life as we know it, perhaps our faith traditions need to rise to the fore again, and we need to dig deeply into them and drink from them and discover the power that is there. As I've began to muse about that, and power, moral power, the power to live righteously, that is in right relationship in this great earth community, moral power being spiritual power. As I've began to ponder that, it's become clear that the Bible is full of stories of power, that we have the power of the Spirit. We've been taught as Christians, especially as women, not to think about power. But power to live towards God's way is what we're given and called to. I've begun to notice, reading church history, that there's another great contradiction. We live a life of acquiescence. We are Christians, and we live a life of complicity with domination. We sort of agree to walk down this path, trying not to, but not getting out of it. And the contradiction is that we are descendants of a great cloud of witnesses that resisted. And resisted forces of domination no less impenetrable than the global economy of our day. We are their descendants. They are our forebears. And there are many of them. There are many great resistors. We could probably name them. I've been working with Irenaeus, a second century theologian who, for one thing, preceded the notion of original sin, but who defied Rome. He and his community defied the power of Rome, and it meant being brutally killed, tortured to death. And given, because of their Christian faith, they resisted. Rome was no less impenetrable than the global economy of our day. And then we go on, and another community that I'm familiar with is a group of medieval women, the Beguines, who resisted, defied the papacy's claim to truth and salvific power. And we think about others. We think about Martin Luther resisting the claims of the church at that time. We think about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We think about the South Africans and the Central Americans. And you begin to ask, why did they have the power to subvert domination in their day, where we tend to not have that power? Dan?
I just want to say, you hit on it. If you exercise that kind of power, spiritual power, you're going to suffer. And if you're not willing to suffer, you won't exercise the power.
Well, maybe that's a profound truth there. Life as we know it tries to get out of suffering. We try to keep our children from suffering. We believe that life is good as long as we're not suffering. That may be a very key thing.
Why do you suffer? Because the system will rise up against that kind of power? Is that it?
And to resist and to change. I'm thinking of the Native Americans. They've been great at resisting right from the start. A lifestyle that they saw destructive spiritually and, you know, Father God, Mother Earth. And they resist and do resist, but they pay the price.
But they pay the price.
And you know, you're talking about your children and how hard that is. Well, to do that, you have to pay the price, and your children are going to pay the price too. And if you get a community together and they do something that's against the principalities of the day, they're going to pay the price.
I think linked
sacrifice.
I think that's, I mean, I the Jesus story is that that's true.
Yeah.
I also think the Jesus story holds a paradoxical thing in dance with that. I think that while we also need to hold that truth, that suffering is entailed in resistance, we also need to hold on to the fact that Jesus didn't come to suffer, and we're not here to suffer a sacrifice. We're here to live life abundantly. So somehow in the midst of deciding to live radically differently, knowing that suffering is entailed because you come up against the principalities and the powers, and as who was it said, you better decide to look good on wood, also we're called to abundant life. We're called to rejoice and share and live abundant life. We're not called to sacrifice or to suffer. Maybe we're called to accept that as the result of living life fully. But there's something that dances with that, and that's that we're called to rich, full abundance of life.
Well, we suffer for a reason. We don't suffer just because we want to suffer.
And perhaps that's it.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to, oh, go ahead.
In times of old, you had the prophets that went and challenged the kings. Mm-hmm. How about in this day, church leaders, whether it's the Pope or challenging the political leaders? There's a lot of what's going on in economic issues, the IMF, the wars we're engaging in, that's political. And where are the church leaders?
So the voice of prophecy is being muted.
Yeah, well, who are, I think the more...
the church leaders.
Yeah, I think the more appropriate question is, who are today's prophets? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily church leaders.
Well, James Lindbergh of Luther Seminary makes the argument that today's prophets are the ones we've always had, Amos, Jeremiah, Isaiah.
Interesting. Wow. Yes. And we need hear them. That's fascinating. That is fascinating. Walter Brueggemann also, and you mentioned him earlier, speaks about the, well, we'll talk about this in a later session, but yes, I'd like to affirm that those prophets are present. And our call as Christians is to, and Jews is to hold them up. I feel a little bit in a bind because I'd like to keep talking, and I'd also know that we only have about 4 minutes, 5 minutes left, and I want to just throw out to you where I see us going. Is that okay?
That's fine.
And maybe given the shortness of time, I'll just maybe read a paragraph to you to try to say where I hope for us to go. I would just like to suggest that we're part of a tradition. That is, our community is centuries old. And our tradition, well, this relates to what you just said, Leroy. Our tradition beckons us to journey into the holy terrain of our forebearers' lives, seeking guides toward moral power, which we, in the contemporary context of economic globalization, might learn. Turning as Christians to forebearers in our tradition, we encounter a contradiction which both startles and whispers hope. While our tendency may be acquiescence, we are descendants of a cloud of witnesses whose relationship with the God who came to live in them empowered resistance to systems of domination. We're well advised to seek the wisdom of these ancestors who drew no distinction between morality and spirituality. And I would suggest that many of them were mystics in the sense that they knew and believed that God dwelled in them. To quote Irenaeus, the dew of the Holy Spirit, what does he say? The dew of God's Spirit is diffused throughout us and all the earth. And I'd like to just suggest to us that we look further, probe the notion that God lives in us, not in just a spiritualized way, but in a profound way, granting us the power to love. Many, many of our forebears can provide, can be guides to us. 2 years ago when I was here, we looked at Irenaeus of Lyon and the ways in which he provides guidance towards a radically different moral life for us today. I'd like us, towards the end of our time together, to probe Martin Luther. Martin Luther as a mystic, who, although most of us don't know because we haven't read it and haven't been taught it, speaks about, literally, us, Jesus Christ coming to live in us, transforming our lives into great wellsprings of power to live righteously. And I'd like us to ponder, explore the notion that the kind of power we need to, in community, subvert the systemic domination that demands us to exploit others and the earth, the kind of power for subversion may very well be present in us as we come to know ourselves as houses, dwelling places of God, of the God who, as you were saying, Dan, lived the affirmation of life, even in spite of death by torture on a cross. And if we, as theologians and mystics, come to know well that power, perhaps our capacity to resist and revision and rebuild may grow and begin to transform us. Mm-hmm. So to contextualize this in the next few times together, what I'd like to do is spend the next couple of times really trying to look at what's going on. Look at the ways in which the global economy is depoliticizing our lives, taking away our democratic power, taking away our power to participate in shaping the common good. That's one thing we'll look at. The second thing we'll look at the next time is how we are taught myths, how ideologies of capitalism, teach us myths, and they're myths by which we live, and they're myths about freedom, they're myths about who we are, they're myths about power, and that they take away, as you said, Woody, earlier in facing the Indian beggar, they feeling powerless, that some of the myths by which we live take away our power, and that we need to disclose and refute those myths. And then I'd like to look more at mysticism, the knowledge of God, the knowing of God within us as a source of power. So that's kind of a preview of looking towards where we might go. Any comments, questions? In closing then, maybe let me ask you to just reflect for a moment for the voices within yourself and try to hear the voices that, given what we've been discussing and given the tendency towards despair and hopelessness, listen for the voices in you that would sabotage faithful response to the domination with which we live, that would sabotage your going forward as Christian people with the power to resist. Can you hear, just quiet and close the eyes for a moment, and hear the voices that would keep you in tracks of exploitation, that would stop you from having power to resist? They may be voices of your parents, of your children, of your community, of your own self. Now we could just come back to a place of togetherness with eyes open. And would anyone be willing to share some of those voices, those tendencies inside that might sabotage faithful response?
But I deserve those things.
I would.
Anyone? Did you want to?
I hear the voice of Cargill. Mm-hmm. I hear the voice of ConAgra. Mm-hmm. I hear the voice of Murphy Feeds. Mm-hmm. And squeezing the life out of our rural people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. those are the voices to whom you are pastor sometimes too, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. I hear the voice of, I do not have time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the other side, I hear the voice of many of my own family members who would say, who I love, and who would call themselves strong Christians, mm-hmm. and who would say, that's not my reading of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yes, of course. Or Jesus has nothing to do with the political life.
Right. Mm-hmm. All those social justice people, mm-hmm. then they kind of just lump mm-hmm. everybody into one yeah. camp.
I hear the voice of that you need good Christian people in positions of leadership in these, you know, the having a moral voice, you know, making it's okay, the Bible talks about how you sow the seed and you get a return on it, some, you know, it's okay to get a return on your investment. It's okay to, in fact, it's better to have a Christian in a position of decision making these multinational companies than not having a Christian there.
I hear the voice of television commercials that say, why be satisfied with a little when you have a lot?
Oh.
Right.
That's a good one.
This is me out.
But you got to take it all on.
Yes, that's a very powerful voice, isn't it? Oh my God, I've got to change it all. And then you just sink back and say no. And then you claim a life of private morality alone. Then you say, I'll be a good person to everyone I know and try to walk away from the bigger picture. That's a very powerful voice, and we're not called to take it all on. Mm-hmm. We're not called to take on everything. I guess I would ask a kind of homework assignment, and that would be because I firmly believe that we are sabotaged by all of these voices, that they are loud and they're real, they're extremely real. The voices, they're probably voices in your parish, that are those voices, the voices of our parents, the voices of our honest self saying, I can't take it all on. I firmly believe that naming the voices that will stop our faithful response is one of our most important tasks. Putting them out there, and then you can talk to them. And you can say, I don't need to take it all on, but I can become knowledgeable about this piece. I can slowly gather around me a community. What I'm asking is, name one of the sabotaging voices within you and talk back to it. And think about the people who are part of your community that can help you talk back to it. That would be my kind of homework assignment for the follow-up on this. Not to dwell with that voice, but to make sure you see it clearly and can gather at least someone to help you refute it. Be it a friend, be it a spouse, be it another voice within yourself.
It's a very Hebrew concept of naming the demon.
Oh,
and it seizes its power over you, and the whole Old Testament idea of naming the animals and naming that, it's...
I find that very helpful. It can be demonic, the voices that keep us from walking the path to which we're called, the voices that keep us from loving neighbor.
Uh-huh.
Get thee behind me, Satan. We need to stop. Thank you for participating in this bit of journey with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.